Yesterday we spoke at the end of the hour about the failure of the conciliar movement. I spoke in general terms about that and said I would send up the Council of Basel today. But I think it's better to subsume the Council of Basel under this head. So I'm going to make under the failure of the conciliar movement, number one, actions of the Council of Conscience. This is a sort of resume, that's number one, but I think is important. Number one, actions of the Council of Conscience. Under this is small a, it's claims. And the supporters of papal absolutism have had a problem ever since in the fact that in the fourth and fifth sessions of the Council of Conscience, after John 23rd had fled, and the members of the council were afraid that they were going to lose, that the Pope would or say the council was dismissed and they wouldn't be recognized the council anymore, they then passed very strong action, declaring that a council is the supreme authority, and that it has the power to depose popes or to order things throughout the church, that it is supreme and all popes are subject to it. Now, also for many years it had been felt that whatever a council decided, a general council, that was the authority in the church. The Council of Nicaea, of course, as you know, the first general council, settled the important matter of the Trinity. And the first four councils made such definite statements that have been adopted ever since by nearly all Christian groups, that the idea of great authority of a council in the church became established long before and there were any number of people, any considerable number, who thought of a bishop of Rome as having any authority in the church outside of Italy itself, or generally perhaps even outside of Rome itself. And so when a council now took this very definite stand, it has made a problem ever since as to what is the authority, the council or the pope. Theoretically, they would stand together. Here they clashed, and the council asserted its supreme authority. So these claims of the fourth and fifth section have made a tough problem for the defenders of the Roman system, and some have tried to get around it by saying that the council was not it was only authoritative insofar as Pope Martin V gave his sanction to it and approved them. And in recent Roman Catholic books, you will find the statement made that any council has authority only as a pope accepts it and gives it authority. But that was a rather recent attitude. And so the way they tried to get around this often has been to say that when Gregory VII submitted to the council and gave it his blessing, then it became an ecumenical council. And, of course, that would root out everything before that as not being a source. But there were some actions after that which are pretty hard to reconcile with the claims of the Pope. And so, perhaps from their viewpoint, the more satisfactory attitude is to say that Martin V approved of certain things in the Council, not of the Council as a whole. But number A, small a with its claims, B is its result. As its result, the Pope had to recognize a great authority in the council for some time. The council said there must be a new council in 5 years, another 7 years thereafter, another every 10 years after that. And Martin V solemnly agreed that he would do that. And that was adopted as a definite policy to be carried on. Martin V declared that he would follow. But the results were not lasting because you have a group of people and a changing group, a group which theoretically includes great numbers of people. And this group changes its complexion from time to time, and all its men have other things which are their primary concern, and over against that you have one man in a position of real authority with very large funds at his disposal and great prestige, and in a conflict between two such, it is quite easy to see which one it will succeed, provided he has a certain amount of shrewdness. And, of course, the papal system has this great element of strength in it from a human viewpoint of having the one man with control and power to make plans ahead and not have to submit them at each step. But another great element of power in the papal system has been the fact that no pope has been able to bind a subsequent pope, and that no pope can determine who his successor will be. Many a pope has tried to determine who his successor will be, but very, very rarely have they ever succeeded. The pope appoints the cardinal, but he cannot make the cardinals promise in any binding way as to what they'll do after he's dead. And then after the pope is dead, the cardinals elect the new pope, but they can't bind the new pope in any way as to what he's going to do after he takes office. They try it frequently, but he always has his supreme dispensing power to relieve himself of any promises that he may have had before being elected. And so they have never been able to do this. And thus you have a system which has a flexibility to it, that you have a pope with certain ideas, certain attitudes. He can't make it hereditary. He cannot keep it in his family. He cannot bind his successors. There is a new man in a position where his position is important, and he wants to maintain it, and he has flexibility and opportunity to proceed and to try to do so. There are certain, from a human viewpoint, great building advantages in the situation, you see. And while most of the leaders of thought in Europe at this time were strongly for the idea that a general council is the real determining body, yet their ideas in the hands of, as opposing shrewd popes who came into office in the next few years, their ideas were gradually pushed to the side. But we want to look a little at the account of how that occurred. And here the particular thing of importance is a council which is sometimes spoken of as one council and sometimes as two councils. I will entitle number two, the Council of Basel, Ferrara, Florence. The Council of Basel, B-A-S-E-L, -, Ferrara, F-E-R-R-A-R-A, -, Florence, F-L-O-R-E-N-C-E. Yeah, I'll spell it again. Basel, B-A-S-E-L, Basel, and then Ferrara, F-E-R-R-A-R-A, and then Florence. I guess you all know how to spell Florence. The council, there was an English family in Florence one time who named their daughter after the city. And from that there's come to be a name that you come under every once in a while now as a woman's name, Florence. But the city of Florence was the last city where part of this council met. And so sometimes the council is called the Council of Basel, Ferrara, Florence. Sometimes it is spoken of as if it were two councils, the Council of Basel and the Council of Ferrara, Florence. Thus, in Schoch's volume here on this period, he has a heading which he calls the Council of Basel, 1431 to 1449. And then he has a separate heading which he calls the Council of Ferrara, Florence, 1438 to 1445. Now, those of you who are expert mathematicians have probably already noticed a very interesting fact, that the so-called Council of Ferrara, Florence starts 7 years after what he calls the Council of Basel, and that the so-called Council of Ferrara, Florence ends 4 years before the Council of Basel ends. And in McSorley's book, in the body of the book, he speaks of the two councils. But at the end of the book, he gives a list of all the ecumenical councils, telling who called them and briefly what they did and where they met. And he puts it as one council. He lists ecumenical councils from 1 up to 20 when he wrote the Second Vatican Council had not yet met. And he calls 17 the Council of Basel, Ferrara, Florence, and listed as one council. Now this shows something of the complexity of the situation. And the reason for the complexity was that the struggle was in the process of continuing at this time. The Pope had promised, I will call the council after 5 years. Well, you remember how he called a council after 5 years, and then he found an excuse to transfer the council to another place, and he managed to work things out, as McSorley said, to make excuses in such a way as to close up this council without it having accomplished anything. And so he had succeeded in making one big step forward in overcoming the authority of council. But he had promised he would call another after 7 years, after this one. After the one at Pavia, which they don't even count as a council. But the next one, he promised he'd call in 7 years. And he would like to have forgotten all about it, but there was considerable pressure on him. And so Martin V called the council. And he called it to meet in the city of Basel in northern Switzerland, right on the edge of Switzerland and France and Germany. Right at that corner there, the city in which Karl Barth taught in the university in recent years. In that city, this council was called to meet. Well, Martin V died before the council got underway. We'll call what we've looked at so far, small a, the calling of the council. The calling of the council. Martin died before it was underway, and his successor, Eugenius IV, Eugenius, E-U-G-E-N-I-U-S, Eugenius IV, was a man who had been made a bishop by his uncle, the last of the Roman popes in the schism, Gregory XII, at the age of 24. Now he was elected as pope, and he was a shrewd man like Martin, and not a man tied to Martin by any ties of blood. As a matter of fact, Martin's relatives were among his enemies as he carried on his activities. But Eugenius IV simply proceeded along the line that Martin V had already laid down. The council was called, but when the council was supposed to start, there was only one prelate present. And so this was March 7th, and the formal opening was postponed until July 23rd. But the papal legate who had been appointed to preside didn't even get there until September 9th. And thus it was rather slow in getting underway. There were a great many of the lower clergy there and comparatively few bishops who were taking part of it in the beginning. There was an interesting character there named Aeneas Silvius, who came to the council as the secretary to one of the cardinals and took a rather important position in connection with the work of the council. The council set to work after enough people really got there to get things really going. They set to work to institute reforms and to do something about the Bohemian situation, because Martin V had called for a crusade against the Bohemians, against the Hussites. And several large armies had gone and been defeated by the Hussites. And in this very year, 1431, a large army had been defeated and driven back by the embattled peasants of Czechoslovakia, without much of the good weapons that were available at the time, simply with their farm implements. They were able to beat them back. And the result was that the council had to try to find something, way to deal with this problem. And also, they wanted to institute reforms in the church. But very soon it became clear that this council did not acknowledge any authority over itself, and that it was determined to really make reforms, and it felt that its authority would make them, and the Pope was simply to carry them out. And so when December came of this year, Eugenius decided he'd had enough. And he announced that he was transferring the synod to Bologna in Italy. And that although the Switzerland and the whole region of the Alps was in between, this was getting it down nearer to his territory and where he could try to exert more influence over it. And the synod, when they heard about it 4 weeks later, they quickly gave an answer that they were going to continue sitting, that they had the authority. He had no authority to start. And in February, they said that Eugenius must personally come, and that a pope had no authority to stop a council or to transfer it without its own consent. And the pressure became so great that Eugenius bowed to it, and Eugenius saw that the council was actually going to try to remove him if he didn't submit. He issued a series of bulls in which he recognized that this was a general council and declared that it was legitimate from the time of its opening, that any act or prejudicial to it or derogatory to its authority which had proceeded from him, he revoked and nulled and pronounced utterly void. And he sent legates in his name to go to the council and represent him. And they went and swore that they would uphold the action of the council. And Shaw says that most Romanist historians like to pass over this decree with as little comment as possible. Or to say that Eugenius, when he made this, had no idea of confirming all the actions of the synod, that he had been not completely informed of what was actually happening. But there's no evidence for either of these. Eugenius was in a difficult situation here, and he bowed completely for the time being. But he was like a tree which before the wind bends in order to avoid breaking, but ready to spring up again at the first opportunity. But before we see how he did that, we have two other situations to note that were of importance. One of these is small c. C would naturally stand for compromise. Compromise with the Bohemians. After 12 years of fighting off and on, trying to conquer the Bohemians, and finding it themselves unable to do it, the leaders of the council decided that the thing to do was, instead of fighting them and trying to conquer them when they saw they couldn't, was to make some kind of a compromise with them. And so representatives were sent to Bohemia to invite them to send their representatives to the council. And they were given, they were sent a substantial number of representatives with the strongest assurances that they would be in no way interfered with, but would be given the fullest opportunity to present their views to the council. And so a sizable group of men came from Bohemia, came to the council, and there presented their views, and in the course of it, they praised John Huss and Jerome of Prague as great Christian leaders and men who had been wrongly treated, and the members of the council were able to contain themselves and to keep quiet and let them talk themselves up. And then eventually they treated them so nicely that they softened them up to the point where they decided that if they could have the cup given to the laity, that that would be a tremendous step forward. And so that concession was given. They would have the cup given to the laity, and they were a few minor concessions like this were made, and thus the Bohemian group was divided. And if you can't conquer, it's always a good statement, they say divide. And so they divided them, and some of the Bohemians wanted, said, well, why should we fight over this? They're willing to agree that Jerome and John were great leaders and great Christians, and let us use the cup in the service. Let's be united in one church. And many of the other Bohemians refused to do that, and they divided the nation over this. And the men at the council said, one of the abbots at the council afterwards telling about it said, at the start the Bohemians were like ferocious lions and greedy wolves. But he said after much discussion, they were turned into the meekest lamb. And so the council was successful this way in making a compromise, which was presented to the Bohemians in such a way that a large group of them, with these concessions, came back to their relationship, while the others, another still larger group, refused to, and there was internal dissension and division in Bohemia, and eventually, 200 years later, all the special privileges were taken away from them, and the Bible was completely forbidden. But the council seems to have been successful in this regard. Now this was overshadowed by a new situation which developed. So we'll call chapter small d, the situation in Constantinople. Now we have been looking most of our time lately at conditions in the West. But we saw some time ago the rise of Islam. And we saw how as early as about 700 A.D., how the Muslims had come right to the gates of Constantinople, though they had been repulsed. Then the Eastern Empire, thus, which had originally been as large or larger than the Western portion of the empire, was cut down quite small. And then we had about 1000 A.D., the Seljuk Turks had gotten control of the Mohammedans in that whole area of the Near East. And they had made it more difficult for pilgrims to go to Palestine, and this led to the outbreak of the Crusades, which after two centuries ended without really accomplishing much, except that they had held Jerusalem for a number of decades in the course of the early part of the Crusades. But in one of the Crusades, the Crusaders had attacked the leadership in Constantinople and had taken over control there for a number of years. And this hadn't pleased the people of Constantinople, that area at all. But now a new development had come. Starting at about 1300, another group of Turks called the Ottoman Turks had come from the east and had gained control of most of the Muslim areas, and they were more able fighters than the previous one, and the empire of the Muslims in the east was thus during this time growing and growing until they took most of Asia Minor. They had all of the part of Asia that had formerly been Christian except Asia Minor. They had most of Asia Minor in their hands, and they bypassed Constantinople and conquered Bulgaria. And so Constantinople was left with a very small region to control, and in a very difficult situation, and the people were ready to do almost anything to get help. You remember that during the 11th century that the division between East and West had come, and the Pope had excommunicated the Eastern Church, and the Patriarch of Constantinople had excommunicated the Western Church. And the two had been divided since that time into the Orthodox Church of the East and the Roman Catholic Church of the West. It was that division which had occurred. Well, now the people in the Constantinople area were desperate, and they were ready to do anything to get help. And so they sent representatives to Basel. They sent representatives to Basel asking if they could have a meeting and consider a reunion of the two churches. And they also sent their representatives to Eugenius IV. And Eugenius found that by having a council to meet at Ferrara in Italy, he would have more control over it. And he announced now again that he was going to move the council to Ferrara in Italy. And so it was both these groups were trying to get the Greeks to meet with them and consider reuniting Christendom. So this situation is D. Now E is the coming of the Greeks. And the Greeks here exerted a great influence, because the whole matter of the council and the matter of reform, all these things were overshadowed to quite an extent in the eyes of most of the leaders in the West with the possibility of reuniting Eastern and Western Church into one united church. And with the possibility of this, this was quite overshadowed. And if the Greeks had negotiated with the council in Basel, that probably would have enabled conciliarism to be strong for a much longer time than it was. But as it was, the Greeks saw that the council was a group of people who came together and were very enthusiastic while they were together and very anxious to carry out what they thought was right, but then they would be scattering to their own areas, and there was no continuing force and power there that could gather force to help the Greeks against the Turks. But that the Pope, who was saying, we'll move the council to Ferrara, the Pope represented a continuing organization which could probably give them more help. So in the end, the Greeks decided to do all their negotiating with the Pope and the council that he would preside over. And this is why the Council of Ferrara Florence is called from 1438, the Council of Basel Ferrara Florence from 1431. Because in 1438, the council
the Pope began a council in Ferrara, which was theoretically a continuation of the Council of Basel. Now, did I say, small e, the coming of the Greeks? There were 700 representatives of the Greek church king. 700 representatives, including the Emperor of Constantinople and the Patriarch of the church, most of their ecclesiastical leaders. They came at the expense of the Western church, which provided the shipping for them, brought them from Constantinople. They came and met at Ferrara. And so F will be apparent success at Ferrara. Well, the Council of Basel now was informed. The Pope is transferring the Council from Basel to Ferrara. Well, before, when he tried to transfer it to Bologna, the Council had been able to completely overcome his effort, and he had completely submitted. But now, with the prospect of union with the Eastern Church, that overshadowed things in people's minds to so great an extent that though the council tried to declare the Pope has no right to transfer the council, we are meeting here, we are the authority, the Pope went right ahead with the council, and quite a number of the people from Basel went to Ferrara and joined with the Pope in this conference with the Greeks as to how to reunite the two churches. And so we have F, apparent success at Ferrara, 1438 to 1445. Well, they call it Ferrara Florence because when, after time, he moved it from Ferrara to a city that wasn't extremely far from there, Florence. But it moved two cities, one for a time, and then the other, rather near each other, in Italy. The council met, and with all these prominent Greek leaders, the emperor and the patriarch and all of their leading ecclesiastical authorities, it seemed a tremendous thing. It seemed to Europe in general, here was the council meeting to reunite all of Christendom. How silly then to fight about little things like reforming the church and the question of authority of council and all that when we have an opportunity to do this big and tremendous thing. And so they had the meeting there, and Eugenius was very anxious to succeed in uniting them. His name would be remembered permanently if he could unite the two churches and put an end to this schism which had lasted for 400 years already. And he was using every bit of tact he could in order to try to do it. But he had with him certain diplomats and certain scholars who felt that the things that each Western church stood on were important, and they should not just surrender any of their doctrine. And he himself was probably ready to surrender most anything but one thing. That was the Pope must be supreme. He must still have his supremacy, and that's, after all, what they actually divided over in the first place. The Patriarch had always been ready to say, the Pope and the Patriarch are two leaders. I'm ready to give the Pope precedence, because Rome is the great ancient city older than Constantinople, but a precedence of standing rather than of authority. We stand equal. While the Pope said, we are supreme, you are under us. Well, the Greeks, it didn't require as much tact as Eugenius might have thought, because the Turks were pushing forward hard, and the situation looked very desperate, and they were ready to give him the most anything if they could get Western help to save their part. And so they agreed to just about everything that was asked. And they made an agreement whereby the two churches would now be united together, and they represented that the Roman bishop had a primacy over the whole world, he himself being the successor of Peter and the true vicar of Christ, the head of the whole church, the father and teacher of all Christians, to whom in Peter Christ gave authority to feed, govern, and rule the universal church. And of course, one thing they'd been very much indignant about was that the Western church had added the word filioque in the creed. Well, they said, we are willing that it be put in the creed, if you will agree that when we read it in our churches, we can just leave it out, just skip it as we read. And so that seemed like a compromise. It was in the written creed, and that would mean it eventually had come to be read all the time, even if for a time they just skipped it when they read. And they surrendered practically everything. And so the articles of union were incorporated into the decree the Pope gave, beginning with the words, let the heavens rejoice and the earth be glad. They said the black darkness of the long schism had passed away before the ray of concord. The articles were signed on July 5th in 45 by 115 Latins and 33 Greeks, of whom 18 were metropolitans. There was only one of the Orientals, the Archbishop of Ephesus, who refused to sign. The Patriarch of Constantinople had died a month before, but had written his approval of the union, and his body is still buried in Florence, in Italy. And it looked as if a tremendous victory had been accomplished. Apparent success at Ferrara, Florence. Then small g, though, rejection in Constantinople. Rejection in Constantinople. The leaders of the Eastern Church, most of them agreed to sign all this. After all, it's better read than dead, and they were ready to do most anything to get a union which might bring troops and help and protection. But when they got back, they were hooted down by the local people who said that there's no reason we should surrender everything we stand for and everything we believe in. The patriarchs of Jerusalem, Antioch, and Alexandria issued a letter from Jerusalem denouncing the Council of Florence as a synod of robbers and the Byzantine patriarch as a matricide and a heretic. A Latin cardinal published the articles in the leading church in Santa Sophia, because the leaders there, knowing how desperate the situation was, were able to give him this opportunity to declare the churches are now united, the Pope is in charge, is in control. But 6 months later, the Mohammedans broke through the walls, took the city of Constantinople, put a complete end to the Eastern Empire, and the great mass of the Eastern Church utterly ignored these symbols, and a cousin, or a sister, I believe, the last emperor, had married the Tsar of Russia, and they recognized a Russian leader as the new patriarch of the Eastern Church, and refused to give up what they'd been standing for all these years and to pay any attention to this agreement made at once. So as far as a reunion of the churches was concerned, this was an utter failure. But as far as increasing the power of the Pope was concerned, it had a great effectiveness, because it seemed for a time as if he'd been completely successful in accomplishing one of the greatest things that could be accomplished, to get the two churches together and to gain the supremacy over the whole of Eastern and Western churches. And the Council of Basel was pretty well overshadowed by what was done here at Florence, Ferrara. And so there we go back to Basel. A continued conciliarism at Basel. I don't remember the exact date. They're fairly near each other. I mean, I could easily find it, but I did not. It's one continued council in that general area. But it's usually called the Council of Ferrara, Florence, because part of the time it was in Florence. And, of course, they very generally say the Council of Basel, Ferrara, Florence, because theoretically it's one council. But actually, the great majority of the people in Basel stayed in Basel. And when the Pope said he transferred it to Ferrara, they were just as indignant as they had been before when he tried to transfer it to Bologna. And so, in 1437, when the order had been given to transfer it, but before the actual start had been made in Ferrara, the overwhelming majority in Basel voted to declare the papal bull null and void and summon Eugenius within 60 days to appear before it. And 4 months later, in beginning of 1438, it declared Eugenius suspended. And in 1439, it declared that it removed, deposed, deprived, and cast Eugenius down as a disturber of the peace of the church, a demoniac and perjurer, incorrigible and errant from the faith, a schismatic and a pertinacious heretic. And they declared all these things about the Pope, and declared that the council was supreme, the Pope had no authority to move it or to oppose its action, but interest had moved to form. And the council continued after this for another 11 years, as you notice, even going on 4 years after the council at Ferrara was dismissed,
But more and more people ceased to pay attention to it, and various leaders came to find that the winning side was in Florence and to transfer their support to it. Yes? In the date of the Council of Basel is 1431 to 1449, but Florence Ferrara is 1438 to 1445. Yes, that's the beginning of it, 37, 38, 39, step after step there. They declared it. Of course, in those days, it would take us 2 or 3 weeks to get the message from one of these places to another. So it isn't like today when you can do something and it's flashed around the world. It might be, it might take a month to get word to them, then it might take another month to get word back of his reaction, and then they take another action, and so on. But the council here then proceeded to elect another pope. They declared he was removed. They elected another pope, the Duke of Savoy. They elected him as pope, and he took the name of Felix V and appointed 4 cardinals. And there were some people in the West who were supporting him, but most of them, remembering the miseries of the previous schism, did not want another one. And so for a number of years, Felix tried to be established as pope, but did not get any great support, and in the end, he surrendered and was again made a cardinal and a bishop in the church. And that's the last time there's been an anti-pope. There may have been, in the previous 1,000 years, McSorley probably lists 30 he calls anti-popes. If you leave out the ones in the time of schism, there's probably 20 times when 2 men were elected pope by different factions and each claimed to be pope. But since that time, so great was the fear of another schism like this, that since that time, there never has been another time when 2 men claimed to be pope. And here, for just a brief time, under the Council of Basel, this claim was made. But the great claims which the council made had considerable number of supporters, but gradually the supporters fell away. And so we say, small j, failure of the Council of Basel. In the end, you might say, it just petered out. 4 years after Ferrara Florence had ended, they were still trying to maintain their claim, but they were not, they were losing supporters all the time. And in the end, the Council of Basel is considered just a part of the Council of Basel Ferrara Florence, usually. And of course, the council was very famous for the 2 things it did for the Bohemians, the way they split the Bohemians, and thus weakened them to the point where 200 years later they could be completely brought under the iron heel of the Emperor of Austria, and the way in which they made what seemed to be a tremendous victory at Florence in relation to the East. But that, of course, under the way the first time worked out, didn't amount to anything. In 1453, Constantinople was taken. You see, that was 8 years after the end of the Council of Ferrara, but it took that time, getting these people back there, making the announcements, and all that. It was 7 years after the Council of Florence ended that this Latin leader pronounced him the greatest church in Constantinople. We are now one church, and the Pope is supreme, and all that. But 6 months later, in 1453, the Mohammedans had the city, the great Christian churches were all, had their Christian symbols all eradicated, and Mohammedan inscriptions put up, and it's been one of the great Mohammedan cities ever since, 1453. The, yes? Because he ordered the council move to Florence. To Ferrara, rather. He ordered them to move to Ferrara where he would have them right under his control. And they refused to do that. They said he had no right to move them without their concurrence. And they refused to go along, but some of them went. And with those who went, he claimed this was the continuation of time. While the majority claimed to stay there, and claimed to be the continuation, but in the end they lost that. And so, number 3, the later... see, this was number 2, the Council of Basel, Ferrara, Florence. Number 3, the later state of conciliarism. The later state of conciliarism. The theory of conciliarism remained in the church side by side with the theory of papal monarchy for some time. But the papal monarchy had the power.
And so it became more and more just a field. 100 years later, a papal council declared that a council has no authority except as a pope gives it to it. But they still were those who continued to hold this view. And when Martin Luther found, to his great surprise, that the pope was opposing what Martin Luther was convinced was the truth, he then appealed from the pope to a general council to be held in the future. And when he did that, the pope then declared that anyone who would appeal against the pope to a future general council should be excommunicated. So far had the feeling changed by that time. But many still held to this conciliar idea. But conciliarism pretty well died out. Now, it was revived to a slight extent when Pope John decided to call another council. But it was very different from what the council wanted, that every 10 years there'd be a council, and it would be the dominant body of the church. There was no council after Basil Ferrara for another nearly 100 years. And then there was none after that for many years, and then for about 300 years there was none. The Pope had things right in his power, and then on. Well, now, that's the later phase of conciliarism. And now, capital F, the strengthened papacy. The strengthened papacy. The papacy came out of the great schism, which looked as if it would completely wreck it. It's a capital F. It came out stronger than ever, due to the fact that some men of very considerable shrewdness took the position of control of the papacy, and that these men for a time didn't make their major activity trying to control the nations of Europe, but set to work to build up their center, to build up Rome, to build up their prestige, their power, and their standing. And the city of Rome, which had become pretty much a waste and full of ruins and a very difficult situation for ordinary living, they managed to make into a great metropolis. They built dozens of wonderful great buildings, and they attracted wealthy people to the city and made it a great center of culture and of influence throughout the world. And their emphasis was on it being a great center rather than on the religious attitude. And, of course, another thing that entered into it was that civilization of Europe was rapidly going forward in these things. After the long period of darkness, they had begun to advance, and the advance was proceeding more and more rapidly. There were more and more people who were having an opportunity to develop their abilities in many different lines. And the folks were able to bring a great deal of this to Rome and to use a great deal for the enhancement of their power and prestige. And so we have a period after this of about 80 years in which the popes had very little opposition anyway, and in which they were able to build up their power in every way tremendously, and also to have the greatest luxury they could possibly desire for themselves and for their families. And the matter of the reform in the church, which the Council of Constance had been so determined to carry on, and the Council of Basel had to, was constantly given lip service, but forgotten otherwise. Almost every time a new pope was appointed, the cardinals would all say, now we're going to reform the church. Whoever of us is elected, he's going to see to it that the spiritual life of the church is improved and that the corruption is done away with in many different ways. But then once he became pope, he set to work to enhance his own position and that of his friend. And now a new factor came into the life of the papacy, which is important enough. I'm going to give it another heading here, after F, G, the humanist. The humanist. Now, the term humanist today is very often used to mean those who deify man, those who rule out the supernatural. That is not the meaning of the term as used of that sense. In that, although some of them were in that direction very definitely, but the term humanist, as used for that term, is those who were interested in the history of human civilization and trying to emulate it in their time. They were the men who were interested in the great achievements of the Greek and Roman civilization. They were studying Latin and Greek, and they were
as bringing, they were bringing from them insights on life in general, or just little points of culture and of interest. But they were, they came to be more and more people who were so interested in these things that it overshadowed everything else in their attention. And the Pope soon began to be men who were proud to have these humanists at their court, and who were exalting them in every way, even though a great many of the humanists did not have any interest in religion whatever. One thing that increased this was the men who had come to Ferrara, Florence, these 700 from the East, quite a number of them stayed, never went back. And these men, many of them had manuscripts, ancient Greek manuscripts, and they were interested in the old culture. And Italy was getting more interested in it, and people, Petrarch, you remember, a century before, had been collecting old manuscripts. The great interest was increased in this area, and it got to where the collection of, the possession of an old manuscript, or the understanding of some classical writer, or the working out of some clever, witty presentation, pleased the men who were popes more than anything in the religious area. In McSorley's account of this century here, he has a section here where he describes the humanists, and it's amazing how many of them he speaks of as having been papal secretaries. He says among the most objectionable humanists were Poggio Bracciolini, profligate author of an obscene joke book, who served as apostolic secretary under several popes and unearthed literary treasures from the libraries of France and Germany. Antonio Beccadilli, teacher at Pavia, who wrote filthy poems and flattered the king of Naples. Lorenzo Valla, who apostolic secretary, who showed his critical ability by correcting the defective text of the Vulgate and proving the mythical character of the donation of Constantine, ridiculed scholastic philosophy and the religious life, argued against the temporal power of the Pope, attacked Christian faith, advocated in his book on pleasure the indulgence of every human appetite, and lived up to his own vicious theory when he was apostolic secretary in the Vatican. Well, we'll look at some more of these next week.